Hey, everyone listening to the podcast. This is Ari, and this is a podcast extra exclusive. This is not from the show this week. It's something original for you, and it's an interview of a kind we rarely get to do because it actually involves journalists and legal experts from multiple different TV channels. And the rules around here are usually we don't appear on each other's channels, but you're about to hear a discussion with me and The New Yorker and CNN's Jeffrey Toobin and The View's Sunny Hostin. She's a prosecutor and, of course, a co-host there, and Ross Garber, who's also a CNN analyst and a lawyer who's handled impeachment trials for several Republican governors. All of it is part of a discussion that I helped organize at the 92nd Street Y in New York this week. The focus was on the Mueller probe, and we tried to divide it up into what we really know, like what we've learned from the indictments, and what we know about the report that hasn't come yet, and what we know about Donald Trump and Bill Barr's actions. All of that, plus a little bit of media discussion and questions that we got from the audience. All of that ahead. I hope you'll enjoy it and take a listen. And as always, if you like what we're doing, feel free to give us a rating. We love 5 stars or whatever you think we deserve. Thanks for listening to The Beat with Ari Melber.
Good evening, everyone. Good evening. Good evening. Can you hear me all right? Yeah? My name's Ari Melber, as you heard. I'm thrilled that you're here with us on a big, busy Monday night. I'm honored to be joined by some esteemed colleagues who are lawyers and journalists, Jeffrey Toobin, Sunny Hostin, and Ross Garber. Give them a warm welcome.
It's kind of like the United Nations of legal analysts.
And it's a testament, I think, to their leadership and what good colleagues each of them are, because you could think of us as colleagues in journalism. You can also think of us as competitors, two people who work at CNN, one person who works at ABC, and I'm proud to be at MSNBC and NBC, and I really appreciate everyone coming to have a conversation, and that's what we want to do. I'm just going to say one thing in the open, and then we'll just talk it out. I'm not going to over-moderate it. This is not The Beat. And I already did that once tonight.
When you and think we're not going to argue because it's not The View.
Well, we can argue a little. It's The View. I could just leave at some point. That's like a View move where you stand up to really
I'll
underscore
joy.
Your... You want to do that too?
I'll be joy.
But when you think about where we are, obviously at a very auspicious and interesting and also difficult time for the country legally, I would just throw out a couple of what I would call legal facts in the current moment that we're in. On the one hand, you have a special counsel that was appointed only because of the suspicious way that the president fired the FBI director, who over the course of, by historical standards, a relatively quick probe, had 37 indictments, dealt with foreign and national security issues, and indicted 6 presidential aides, which, if you're counting, means that Donald Trump doesn't just have the record for the fastest indictment rate of advisors in American history, at just over 2 years, but he's out doing other criminal enterprises. I mean, who remembers, and I know Jeffrey does, who remembers Death Row Records, which was founded by Suge Knight, who was an open member of the Piru Blood Gang.
Yeah.
More indictments than Death Row Records. So you can measure it a lot of different ways. It's very bad to have that level of indictment rate. Some of those individuals convicted. No one has been acquitted who's been caught up in the Mueller probe. And some of those individuals, like Mr. Stone, still waiting trial and benefits from the legal presumption of innocence. So that's really bad right over here. Then over here, you have other legal facts that we can reckon with. We don't know what's in the Mueller report. We're going to talk about what we can glean and what we can learn tonight. But we do know that at the end of the thorough investigation that I just described, there was no chargeable election conspiracy.
We don't know of.
Well, there was no chargeable.
Well, there was no charge.
There was no charge to see lawyers.
Yeah, right.
There was no charged election conspiracy.
Right.
And for people who think that that probably happened or basically happened or did happen and wasn't charged, which is a factual possibility, that's also what I would call a legal fact we need to reckon with that has profound implications. Number one, that Bob Mueller didn't ultimately find in a legally chargeable way that the president was elected through a crime. That's an important legal fact that also cuts against some of what I just outlined. And so when we think about this inflection point that we're in, where we've watched this probe proceed, we have this incredibly momentous moment in the country to figure out what does it mean to find that much crime, but also not have a chargeable conspiracy, and then have the president install attorney general who may be in a very profound way minimizing or hiding whatever else was found. What do we do about that as a nation? So I think it's one of those times, not that both things are true out of a false attempt to find balance on the field, but some of both things are true because the lack of the chargeable conspiracy is an important thing we know from where we begin, which is topic number one tonight. I want to start with the indictments, then get to the report, then get to Barr, and then end on the narrators, the media, and the internet. And so kicking it out to you all, what did you glean, what do you learn at this juncture from what we know from the indictments, what was charged and what wasn't?
Well, I think in many respects the most interesting narratives in that Mueller has produced were the two indictments that will never go to trial, the indictments of the Russians who were involved in the social media conspiracy, the people in St. Petersburg who were using social media to help Donald Trump get elected, and then the other indictment, which involved the hacking of the emails from the Democratic National Committee and from John Podesta, that were these remarkable government-led efforts to subvert the electoral process of the United States in a very self-conscious, determined, and successful way. Now, of course, you can never say for sure what it was that tipped the election. I don't think the social media did. I think some of the hacked emails had a very profound impact. And the question that hovered around the Mueller investigation was, what, if any, contact, connection, encouragement, support the Trump campaign gave to those two conspiracies, the hacking conspiracy and the social media conspiracy. And as Ari said, he concluded that there was no chargeable way to include the Trump campaign in those conspiracies. I think one of the most interesting parts of the Mueller report will be the discussions of the contacts that went on between the Russian interests and the Trump campaign. Roger Stone's connections to the hacking, of course, the June 2016 meeting at Trump Tower. They weren't enough to prompt Mueller to charge them, but it will be interesting to see how he puts it all together in a narrative.
Yeah, no, I agree with that. And I think because of sort of the expectations here, there were sort of two points that we kind of whizzed past very fast that I think bear sort of a moment's thought. And I think Ari set it up right. One is that there was this vast Russian effort to interfere with our election system. We know that from our intel services. We now know that from these indictments, and anybody who wants to can read these detailed indictments to sort of see how that worked. And I think because everybody was waiting for the, all right, next part, I think not a lot of enough attention probably has been paid to that, because if it were, then the question would be, all right, so what are we doing to prevent that from happening again? And then the second piece is that notion that notwithstanding that Russian effort, no American has been charged with conspiring or colluding with the Russians. That's also incredibly significant. If we, we're going to learn a lot, perhaps, from the Mueller report and what happens next. But those two points, I think, bear emphasis.
And I'm actually not convinced that the social media campaign didn't have a significant impact on the election. And that's because if you look at the research, between 66% and 79% of Americans get their news on Facebook, 66 and 79%. And if this campaign is as successful as the Mueller investigation and probe found, then we don't know what the impact of the social media campaign was.
It's a fair point.
And that could be fairly significant.
I don't want to jump ahead to the media portion of the discussion, but when I go to events like this, people always want to talk about MSNBC and Fox and CNN, mm-hmm. and I always try to point out that the more important, perhaps, or I think really the more important media phenomenon is the Facebook algorithm.
I believe
that,
so.
That, you know, what you see on your news feed is perhaps more important even than Ari Melber, which is hard for me to believe. But
I think the other thing is, as Ari said, I mean, you're talking about, you know, 34 individuals, 3 Russian businesses, 7 guilty pleas, 4 people sentenced to prison, a 2-year investigation. That is a landmark investigation. And you have the President of the United States saying, you know, witch hunt, witch hunt, witch hunt. This is a hoax. This is a hoax. Well, that hoax found a lot of witches. And every single witch was talking about Russia.
Although, Sonny, in fairness, though, I think what the President was talking about when he talks about witch hunt, mm-hmm. is his involvement and his campaign's involvement in that effort. And so, you know, he says, all right, maybe, but let's assume he actually knows that the Russians, you know, worked hard to tamper with our election. Let's assume that. Mm-hmm. But I think what he's saying is, except I know I didn't do anything. I, as the president, I know my people didn't do anything to conspire, to collude with them.
Well, is it true that his people didn't do anything because Paul Manafort was his campaign chairman,
but wasn't charged with conspiracy or collusion with the Russians.
And he was talking about Russia.
But he's in jail for things unrelated.
Michael Flynn. Everyone in his circle talked about Russia. They weren't talking about Jersey. They weren't talking about Malta. They were talking about Russia.
Right, so, but they weren't charged with conspiring or colluding with
Russia. Well, I mean, Russ,
in fairness.
That is true.
I think also, you know, one of the problems with viewing the entire matter through the prism of a criminal investigation, mm-hmm. is that, you know, we make many conclusions in our life, especially about politics, not using a proof beyond a reasonable doubt standard, which is, you know, in criminal law. You know, one of my mentors in journalism was Michael Kinsley, mm-hmm. who used to, you know, he had what he called Kinsley's Law, which is the scandal isn't what's illegal, the scandal is what's legal. You know, it's what society chooses not to punish that tells you about the prevailing moral standards. And I think if you look at how, you know, the president or candidate Trump behaved during, you know, with regard to Russia, and, you know, we've all seen, you know, I love WikiLeaks and you know, Russia, if you're listening, go find the emails, and Donald Trump Jr. saying, you know, to the Trump, you know, the Trump Tower meeting, if it's true, I love it. I'm willing to
and
concede
not cool.
that's not
right.
criminal, but it's still worth pausing to talk about how bad it is.
But once you say, all right, you know, let's say it's bad, once you pause, then the question is, all right, so what are we all going to do about it? You know, Adam Schiff, the chair of the House Intel Committee, mm-hmm. said essentially what you just said, the misconduct is in plain sight. Yeah. And so now the question is, the House is controlled by the Democrats. Now the question is, what are they doing about it? What are they going to do about it?
Mm-hmm. Well, I don't necessarily think that really is the question about, like, what are they going to do about it? Exposing it is doing something about it. I mean, it's not... every congressional hearing is not designed to sort of pass a law. And I think, you know, especially after 2 years where there was absolutely no oversight from the House of Representatives or the Senate to air out these issues, like, you know, for example, Michael Cohen's testimony from a couple weeks ago, I think that served a very valid purpose, even if it didn't lead to impeachment or, you know, the passage of some new law.
Fair enough, but I'm not sure. And look, in fairness, the Democrats just recently took control. On the other hand, they've been in control for a few months now. And maybe aside from the Michael Cohen hearing, where I think maybe we learned a little bit, although if you pressed me now, I'm not sure I could come up with much. There hasn't been that much that the House has done. And I contrast it with what happened during the Watergate situation, where you did have hearings, you had public hearings, and you had congressional investigations that actually found stuff that the criminal investigators didn't find and exposed it.
Anyway, we can talk about Watergate.
Yeah.
I mean, with Watergate, you know, was years of hearings and years of, and many months of preparation. You know, the Democrats took charge. I mean, they didn't know they'd be in charge until November, and they didn't take charge until January. And, you know, it's the second week in April. I mean, it's not exactly, you know, they're not exactly tarrying around.
It's okay to ask the question.
Well, sure, it's fine to ask.
Right.
I'm against asking any questions.
Exactly.
Oh, of course it's fine to ask.
And I think as we talk about the Mueller report, I think the question is going to become, I think, even more pressing is once we learn, if we learn something from the Mueller report, if it's released, you know, then what? So what? Now that we know that, what's going to happen? Once we say that this conduct is not okay, then, okay, what are we going to do about it? Now that there's an election, that's the most important thing that people can do about it. But is there anything else?
Well, there's always impeachment.
Well, I don't know. Do you want to talk about impeachment? I mean, we can.
Well, two things. Yeah. I think it's interesting to hear, you know, Ross, among other things, handled the defense of three different Republican governors facing impeachment.
Four.
And so you bring that experience. I think one of the things I hear you doing that is smart lawyering, or when we want to be a little more vicious, what we call clever lawyering, is you're reverse engineering out of the last possible nihilist square. Well, it would be very hard to remove this governor or president or whatever. And because that is unlikely, I mean, you could run an algorithm or a historical model to show that it is unlikely, which is to say under 50%. And because it's unlikely, therefore, we should all just
And it is unlikely, and politically, it may not be the best thing for Democrats. Right?
So I think what you may be doing out of force of habit is using that as a thoughtful or clever defense strategy, which is different from saying, well, gosh, you want to get into it. There are points early in the Nixon example where his removal from office did not seem likely. There were points earlier in LBJ's tenure when the notion of that politician not running for re-election because some people were running in primaries seemed unlikely, or the Civil Rights Act, or the Voting Rights Act, or the Housing Rights Act. You can come up with a lot of examples in history that seemed unlikely until they got more likely. So what is your substantive argument based on the facts and the indictments, not the...
I was going in the opposite direction. You know, Jeffrey pointed out correctly.
You could have fooled Tubin.
Yeah. Well, he pointed out correctly that, all right, so Americans haven't been indicted. The president hasn't been charged with conspiracy. His people haven't been charged with conspiracy. But there's really bad stuff going on. All right. And then we have the House Intel chair saying there's really bad stuff going on here, and it's in plain sight. And we've got the Senate Intel chair saying there's really bad stuff going on here if you only knew everything that I knew. And so what I say is not, I haven't gotten to whether I think impeachment is warranted. I'm at the, all right, so what are you going to do about it? The only people that I know who've said no impeachment are the Speaker of the House and the Chair of the Judiciary Committee in the House. They have said, whoa, folks, no impeachment. Everybody relax, no impeachment. And I think that's worth talking about, and I think it's going to be worth even more relevant once Barr gives us whatever party gives us. So I'm not at the, is there justification for impeachment? I'm at, all right, well, what next? What's
what
going to go
do?
On?
Well, Nancy Pelosi is a very smart politician.
Exactly. It's true.
Right? And she knows there could be tremendous backlash when you go down the impeachment route, and Democrats don't have the Senate. So arguably it doesn't make much sense. That doesn't mean that impeachment isn't appropriate here, because if President Clinton was impeached, in my view, for far less, it seems to me that it could be appropriate here.
And
doesn't mean that it would be politically smart.
When you say what else are you going to do about it, are you leaving a gap, like you're implying not a lot's going on?
I'm looking at the facts. What I'm saying is the Speaker of the House and the
No, I understand that she laid down that marker, and I think she has a reason for doing that. If you're saying what's been going on since January, right?
Or November.
You have the use of subpoena power to demand the testimony of five Trump aides. You have the use of subpoena power for an unredacted version of the Mueller report. You have the invocation of the Ways and Means Committee chairman using federal law to get the tax returns. You have state-level efforts.
That's happened, though, and I don't think it's going to happen.
Well, no, everything I just said has happened.
But it hasn't borne fruit, and I don't think it's going to borne.
Well, now, hold on, though. Just to finish, though, before you move the goalposts, those are all things that of the what are you going to do about it that involve the constitutional oversight powers, whether or not it takes a long time or whether or not courts enforce some of those actions. There's also the Cohen testimony. There's also the whistleblowers. There's also the budgetary process. There's also the bipartisan rebuke on Yemen. There's also a bipartisan rebuke on
Southern District of New York.
The national emergency attempt to invoke budgetary powers. I would argue, from a historical standpoint, the last few months have actually been quite active at sub-impeachment level oversight.
So that may be the answer that to the question that I think Jeffrey teed up is, you know, there's bad stuff going on. What are we going to do about it? That may be the answer. It may be that the House has done all they can do. I think time is gonna tell us that. I'm not sure that's the case, but I'm willing to see how it plays out.
You think the House is done already?
No. Absolutely not. But what they haven't done, we know, is started an impeachment proceeding. What they haven't done
would
is...
Would you countenance that before they've even resolved the Mueller report visibility?
House has nothing to do with it. House has nothing to do with the Mueller report. House is a separate branch of government. Well, the House is not supposed to...
Well, let me turn it. All right, I'm going to turn it.
And waiting for
the executive branch. I'm turning it.
Go ahead.
All right.
The way you know that I'm turning it is I'm telling you. but thank you for that piece of that analysis. As promised, that's a bit of indictments and other stuff. The Mueller report.
Yeah.
Starting with you, Jeffrey. Mm-hmm. Were you expecting that it would be this lengthy? What do you think you can glean from what we know at this limited point?
Well, it's approximately 400 pages. Mm-hmm. What we don't know is single-spaced or double-spaced, because that's very important.
We don't know that.
I have to say, I thought it would be in that range. I mean, you know, the obligation to do a report under the special counsel regulation is a peculiarly written piece of government bureaucrat ease, but it certainly gave Mueller the opportunity to write at some length, and he has, and I'm not surprised at that. Mm-hmm. You know, I think it will lay out a lot of the facts. I think what Attorney General Barr has done is given himself four independent reasons mm-hmm. to keep a lot of it off limits. And I don't know that he will. But if you look at the four categories that he said are off limits, grand jury material, classified information, material related to other investigations and material, you know, involving peripheral third parties, all four of those potentially could cover hundreds of pages. And I think Barr will not censor hundreds of pages, but he's given himself the opportunity. I mean, grand jury material, Rule 6E of the Federal Rules of Criminal Procedure has never been defined with great precision. It can mean as narrow as just the testimony itself, or it could be as broad as the subjects that were before the grand jury. Classified information, notorious, the intelligence agencies for overclassifying. Other investigations, Mueller himself has defined that very broadly. And I don't know what the fourth category is, like peripheral third parties. Is that Donald Trump? Is that one of them?
Yeah.
So I think, you know, I don't want to prejudge the final result because I don't know what Barr has done. But he sure has given himself the opportunity to keep a lot of it off limits.
It just seems to me that we don't know at all what's in the report. And it seems to me that that is intentional. It seems to me that this attorney general was chosen because he wrote a 19-page memo. And in that, he opined that the President of the United States is basically above the law and cannot possibly obstruct justice. And I think this president saw that memo and thought, aha, I have my guy.
I think he was told about that.
Told, yeah, yeah, you're right. Yeah.
You don't
you're
think
right.
He read it?
Yeah. You're right. You're right. But that is, you but, agree, but, that but, is but, why he
oh,
is in that position.
Absolutely, but
right?
Like 19
you're right, he didn't read that. So
it was single spaced.
and so that is why he is in that position. I think it is odd that he read, Barr read 400 pages in that amount of time and came up with a four-page memo two days later. I also think that Watergate made it very clear, and, you know, federal judge, the chief judge made it very clear that 6E doesn't supersede Congress's right to get the full Mueller report. And so, in my view, would you agree with that?
Well, I
come
mean,
come on, Jeff.
No, but I think if Barr had gone to court to get a 6E order that said you can do it, he would have done that.
But
I mean,
Congress,
the judge
Congress
would have
has subpoenaed it, though, at this point.
Well,
that, right?
That's not. I mean, that's sort of the next step.
So
we'll
there's
see.
There's
I mean,
an
look,
argument
I,
to
I
be
think
had
the whole
that
thing is
Congress deserves the,
look,
the entire report.
I think
report.
The whole thing is preposterous. The whole they should just like. Photocopy it and give it to
and,
Congress.
And the underlying it. Materials as well. And this president has also said he doesn't care that the American public should see it because he's been totally exonerated. All of a sudden, there's been a walk back. Why the walk back? If you've been totally exonerated, let the American people see that you've done nothing wrong.
And Ari, I'd be interested in your opinion about this. Because I am, you know, I don't understand exactly what went on here, but the part of the four-page letter of March 24th where he said, I have evaluated the evidence and I find there, you know, Mueller couldn't make up his mind about obstruction of justice, but I find there was no obstruction of justice. What was that about?
I don't
well,
get
like,
that
what was
either.
Going on?
I
there?
Think, well, look, I think it'll be very interesting to see in the long run whether that looks misleading. The tell from a lawyering perspective is if there were more good stuff that supported Barr's point, he would have had good reason to quote it. There's not a single full sentence from the Mueller report in the letter, which I think over a few days became clear to people as a bit of a tell. Even the sentence about the fact that this is basically a finding that there was not criminal obstruction, that finding was not at least reached, was lopped off. So it sounded like a reasonable inference might be it started by saying something bad, but this report doesn't find a crime, and they just lopped off the first part. It was almost garish if it was that. It would be very interesting to see in the long run, if we see more, whether Barr did it that way. As for the question of obstruction, which we can get right into, if you follow the policy, which everyone I think in this room has heard about by now, that under both parties, the Justice Department has generally taken the position that you don't indict a sitting president. Mm-hmm. Whether you like that or not, that has been the Office of Legal Counsel's longstanding view. If you take that as a baseline, then a special counsel of the DOJ, when dealing with obstruction, is not looking to then try to reach a finding that would be criminal or indictment. To the extent that there are high crimes, that would go back to the Congress. The Watergate roadmap didn't say we indict the president. It said, look at these findings. Which leads you to one final question. Well, what's the difference with conspiracy?
Mm-hmm.
Well, as Tevye would say, aha! It's not
you're
just rap.
You're just pandering.
It's not
the
just
audience.
Rap. It's rap.
I know.
But also Judaism. Conspiracy involves more than one person. So while I give the White House credit for its good news that Mueller did not charge a conspiracy, good news for them. Had there been a potential conspiracy of multiple people, you could close out this probe by indicting them. Maybe it's some low-level American tech person. Maybe it's some blogger who wanted to help Trump and Donald Trump didn't even know him. Or maybe it goes higher up. Whatever it was, it would be multiple people, and then you might have the unindicted window. So if I were drawing inferences, I'm going to wait for the report. That's our job. But we are talking about it tonight, and we're deep into the process.
We work in cable. Our job is to speculate.
I would
and there's no accountability for being wrong.
I would be very interested to see whether the reason the conspiracy part ends that way is because he didn't charge it. And to the extent there was evidence of obstruction, if and when Congress wants to deal with it, the history in Starr and Jaworski, operating, yes, under different statutes, but still operating with our constitutional system, was Congress looks at obstruction evidence.
It's a good point because, you know, you read the Barr letter, and the implication is that Mueller left it to Barr to decide on the obstruction. That's the implication. But if you read it, if you read the words, it doesn't actually say that.
No.
And it's not clear what Mueller intended. Did Mueller intend to leave it to Barr, or did Mueller intend, like in Watergate, like in Clinton, to leave it to Congress?
To Congress.
Exactly. Now, notably, though, it doesn't seem as if Mueller went to the grand jury, went to the court, and asked for permission to share grand jury materials with Congress, with the House, which I think is notable and interesting. But it's unclear from the Barr report who in Mueller's mind was supposed to decide the obstruction issue.
So as a little bit of a lightning round, and we're now in, for those keeping track, we're now in topic three, the president and his attorney general. What grade do you give Barr on his legal skills for executing the outcome he appears to want thus far, and his transparency, which he promised under oath, everyone?
Well, because I have a great deal of courage, I'm going to give him a grade of incomplete. Because, I mean, we are in the middle of this process, and...
What about on his skills thus far?
Well, I mean, you know, he came in with a lot of credibility because he had been attorney general before in an administration that was not known as polarizing as this one. I think in his confirmation hearing, you know, he trod a line that was politically artful. You know, he kept saying, "I'm all for transparency consistent with the law." In other words, transparency unless I'm not being transparent. And the letter, I think, was not a particularly honorable moment. I mean, I think this volunteering of the exculpatory interpretation of the evidence was really unnecessary, and I think was not. Just did not reflect well on him, but it certainly was very much politically advantageous for the president.
Yeah, I think that when you write a 19-page memo to poison the well and to get a job, you get an F in my book. But
which is worse than incomplete.
Yes.
Yeah. But I'm a hardliner, those of you that know me. I do think, though, that he has an opportunity to change that because we are still in the middle of the process. He's outlined these sort of four categories, I guess, through which he can determine how much of the report the Justice Department is willing to divulge to the American people, although he has, you know, outlined this caveat that he's going to be as transparent as possible. I'd like to see what that sort of transparency looks like.
Yeah, so look, I teach a political investigations and impeachment class, and I am a notoriously easy grader. So I'd probably give him a higher grade for lawyering. Now, my class is not an ethics class. My class is not a good government class.
They teach ethics in law school? I don't remember.
They do, and it's an important class. And in fact, after Watergate, they mandated ethics classes in law school. So. The point, though, is in terms of legal skill, Barr has exhibited, I think, some pretty impressive legal skill to the point where, you know, we're sitting here let me talk about this. So we're sitting here talking about the four categories that Jeffrey outlined, that Sonny adopted, that I think we all adopt generally to think of the categories of things that Barr might excise from the Mueller report. Mm-hmm. There's a fifth category. And what Barr has said about this fifth category, I think, is interesting. The fifth category is stuff that might be covered by executive privilege.
Oh,
so,
that's true.
So Let's say, for example, that report, the Mueller report, has information about interviews that the president's White House counsel gave to Mueller's investigators, where he talked about information that he got from the president. Now, normally, that is stuff that would be covered by the executive privilege. Now, Barr has not disclaimed that he's going to waive executive privilege. The president has said, you know what, you know, put everything out there, but I'm going to trust my lawyers to make a decision on that issue. Mm. What Barr said was interesting and clever, and I think gave an impression that there wouldn't be an executive yes. privilege claim, but that's not what he said. What he said was, because of what the president said, I don't have to submit this report to the White House for an executive privilege review. The president has entrusted that decision to me. And so that's another another category.
So what
few of us
what are
talking
your grades?
About.
That is true.
What's that?
What are the two grades?
What's my grade? Oh, my grade for lawyering is a high grade. Mm-hmm. He's a careful lawyer, and Barr wasn't just the attorney general. He wasn't just the deputy attorney general. He was also the head of the Office of Legal Counsel.
Right. And what about transparency?
Transparency's got to be incomplete because we don't know yet. We don't know.
I just mean based on where we're at now. I would give him an A on the legal skills. Quite impressive, given the hand he's playing, especially. Based on where we are at this juncture, I would give him a C on transparency. On the legal skills, it's actually remarkable when you think of what Mueller accomplished and his standing in American public life. Some would say almost he had been too inflated in the public political mm-hmm. imagination. And Barr comes in as a new attorney general. He's holding the same job that Whitaker and Sessions held mm-hmm. in an administration that does not have a lot of credibility, I would argue, with the press and a large portion of the legal establishment and a majority of the public. And in very, very quick order, he changes the public narrative. He cherry picks, and I think that's an accurate term based on what we know, because he himself admits that he went beyond Mueller's findings, which is why I give him a C and not an F. It's the bit of transparency that we even know to fact check that if you take him at his word. But he shifts it all quite fast, and he does it over a series of time where you literally have Democrats being pressed over their reaction to what was just a summary. Imagine if Jeff Sessions wrote it. I mean, who cares, as Joy Behar would say. Who cares? We haven't seen the report yet. On the transparency, I think it's really mixed and fascinating. Again, at this point, we'll see what he does with the ensuing fight. But on the one hand, he disclosed more than he had to, which is what he said he would do in his hearing, about investigative techniques, the 500 search warrants, ultimately the length of the report, a public timeline, which does create some accountability, all of which was more than the rules require, frankly. While also, and this is why I think it's so dubious, doing that for the express purpose of building Washington credibility, he's such a masterful Washington player, to sell what he really wanted to sell, which is not the conspiracy part, which I think is apparently resolved by the lack of indictments, but to sell a truncated endgame to obstruction, which for other presidents has been a long congressional process.
Is his reputation better today than it was when he first started in office?
Attorney General Barr?
Mm-hmm.
What do you guys think? I think it's gone down a little.
But I think his reputation is the same. Basically, my view of public opinion and the Trump administration is that no matter what question you ask, you get the same answer. Mm-hmm. Is his pop, you know, is should he be impeached? What are you favorable, unfavorable? Do you think we should, you know, immigration policy? It's like 40% think Trump is terrific, 55% think he's terrible, 5% don't know. But I mean, every question you ask, mm-hmm. we get the same answer. And you know, Charlottesville, Helsinki, the kids mm-hmm. in cages at the border, nothing has changed anyone's mind. Mm-hmm. You know, after the Barr letter, oh, what happened? Nothing. Mm-hmm. After the report comes out, nothing's going to change
really?
In terms of public opinion. I'm making
you're
predictions.
Being such a curmudgeon.
Sonny, what would change things, right?
Yeah, I mean,
what would have to happen, right, to change?
I mean, do you disagree?
I disagree.
Do you disagree?
I disagree strongly.
I do.
I think we're living through
a
complete civic and political upheaval.
Yeah.
That is larger than Trumpism, but is partly fueled by it. the popular vote swing in the midterms was wider for the Democrats than any Democratic winning election in over 40 years. Yeah. The number of women running for office was more than any time in American history.
That was a reaction.
And it was a reaction. We know that because 30-some of the elected women in the new Congress were the Democratic Party and one were in the Republican Party. And as a journalist, it would give me great joy if the numbers were better split. They just aren't. So again, that looks like women identifying as Democrats or liberals running, and I think the civic awakening, the participation, the journalism, the interest, all of that in a short period of time is bubbling up. Whether Congress changes, well, no. Congress only changes when its constitution, when its membership changes.
All of that is true and important, but I was just talking about the polls. I mean, you know, the polls, I mean, they don't elect anybody, but the polls matter.
Well, I'm talking about the midterm elections is more important than polling.
Well, it certainly is. It's much more important than polling, but it is also indicative of, you know, changes from November of 2016 to, you know, November of 2018 in mostly suburban congressional districts. It, you know, you did not see any significant change in the Senate because, you know, the Trump support in, you know, the sort of more rural parts of the country has remained very much intact. His approval among Republicans is astronomical.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I just don't think there has been that much change. And I don't think there will be more change, and I think we're heading into a, you know, another close election.
I mean, I brought up the question as to whether or not Barr's reputation has been sullied, because it just seems to me that everyone that touches this administration, the their reputations have been sullied, and it just seems to me that once the Mueller report comes out and people are actually able to see and touch and feel the report and read it and see with their own eyes, hopefully they'll read it, the activity, I just can't imagine that they'll look the other way and not care.
God, Sonny, think
bless
about all
you, yeah.
I just
hope
I can't,
you're right.
I can't imagine that.
Yeah, but think about
because there's been such tension, you know, that that investigative team, and when I was a prosecutor in D.C., some of those folks that are on the team, I knew them. They were crackerjack federal prosecutors, and there were no leaks. Now we know, once Barr sent that letter out, there have been a couple of leaks, and those prosecutors are saying, no, wait for the report.
Yeah.
Some things in that report that you need to see. So I can't imagine once the public sees what is in that report that they aren't going to care about it.
But I think that's one of the difficulties, is setting up these big expectations for what's in this report when, as Adam Schiff has said, there's so much misconduct, according to him, in plain sight. And then think about what we already know about the president. But what is going to change someone's mind?
Here's a prediction that I am 100% certain of. The day that this report comes out, Fox News will say, this is a big nothing burger. It's all known already. Sean Hannity will say, why aren't we investigating Hillary Clinton? And and, you know, that's different from Watergate. You know, I wrote a profile of Adam Schiff, and you know, he's been reading about Watergate, and he said, you know, one thing that's really different from, you know, the media environment of 1973-74 is the existence of Fox News, and I include sort of the internet corollaries to Fox News, you know, that show up in your Facebook feed if you are a conservative. The guaranteed dismissal of the Mueller report from a very important news outlet to the Republican Party is going to have an impact, and I think has an impact in why the polls don't change and in maintaining the loyalty of the Republican base. So I mean, I you know, again, to you know, that's another reason why I think public opinion is locked in regardless of what the report says.
Well, we're leaning right into the final topic before questions, which is the narrators, the press, as well as the internet and that role. And I wonder if you think, compared to other investigations that you've been involved in impeachment, whether that changes anything in a substantive way or just accelerates the information flow.
And I want to pick up on something that Jeffrey just talked about, which I think does distinguish this situation from almost anything. And I just finished reading the Jill Solomon book, Merchants of Truth. Yeah. Very interesting and good book that I think...
What's it about? It's
about the concept that you were just talking about.
Oh,
about
media bias.
About where we are right now in journalism, and it profiles, you know, several outlets, the New York Times.
Oh, Jill Abrams.
Abrams. Oh, okay. Sorry. Yeah, Jill Abrams.
That book must have really stuck with you.
Yeah, I just finished.
Former New York Times editor.
Exactly, right. So anyway, very, very good book, but part of the point is we are now spending a lot of time talking to ourselves, talking to the people with whom we disagree. You know, you go on social media, and it's rare that you'll, you know, see and interact with people who don't agree with you. And I think unless you're a journalist.
Except on The View.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. But do you think the way you were advising governors, for example, historically to now, do you see a difference that actually hits the process or not? Like, for example, in presidential campaigns, we know the rise of the internet has completely changed the dynamic in some ways that are salutary when you look at fundraising and new candidates' ability to break through without coastal donors or without big famous names. Mm-hmm. And in other ways, when you look at the way people criticize the president's use of Twitter, that they think are very negative.
Yeah, and I think it is, but I think it's moved so rapidly. I mean, I've been, you know, doing these political cases for a long time, mm-hmm. you know, and started, you know, back when, you know, people were reading newspapers on actual paper. And and there, information is received and conveyed and taken in and processed in a way different than it is, you know, these days with Twitter. You know, right now, the problem, the issue that Jeffrey points out really has accelerated and has become acute, where, you know, so many people are getting their information from Facebook mm-hmm. and from Twitter and from other social media outlets, which by definition means they are getting it from their own networks, that it can't help but affect the outcome. And I agree with Jeffrey, it's affecting the outcome in the way he describes. It means we are locked into our positions. We're often not listening to each other. There is no authoritative voice or voices like there were back during Watergate, where people would read the New York Times and in particular the Washington Post and take in the information, and it could move public opinion more rapidly.
Most people didn't read the New York Times or the Washington Post.
Or watch TV.
Yeah, but TV is the big difference.
Right.
You had three networks, and you had something called the Fairness Doctrine, because television was a regulated monopoly in those days, and there was no cable. And so there was a legal imperative of Walter Cronkite, Huntley Brinkley, mm-hmm. Frank Reynolds, Howard K. Smith, to present both sides. And, you know, there were accusations of political bias, but, I mean, paling in comparison to what's going on today. And I think that had a real major consequence. So that when John Dean testified before the Senate committee, the Senate Watergate committee, not only was it on TV all day long on the relatively few stations that were out there, but it was also evaluated in a relatively neutral, politically even-handed way, which is inconceivable today.
It is almost inconceivable, and I think sort of coming close to ending almost where I started, I'm willing to entertain the possibility.
And that is progress.
That Congress.
That's how you know you're growing.
Exactly. But I'm going to end where I started.
After thinking this through,
I agree with myself.
The exact way I felt about it before I looked into it.
It is true, though. But so what we haven't seen yet are substantial televised hearings from Congress. And so maybe, I'm not willing to say, I am not going to be a nihilist on this. I am not willing to say that if there is information and it's really bad and it's played out over television during hearings, And then the cable networks covered the Cohen hearing, I think, live.
Yeah.
You could see it on C-SPAN. Mm-hmm. A lot of people tuned in to watch it. I'm not willing to say that if that were to happen, that that couldn't move any opinion.
Well, that's my
point. But it hasn't happened.
If you get to see and touch this report and read it for yourself, why would that not change minds? Why would that not change hearts? If you're reading it for yourself.
But I don't know how many people are actually going to read.
So one of the things.
I guess I'm giving the American people more credit.
Well, part of what we're talking about is the shift in, there's how people view it, and there's the shift in the media space around them. Traditional press, and as you, Sonny, were mentioning, or I think both of you were mentioning earlier, how much people rely on the internet for their worldview or their information.
Everyone read the Star Report.
Just because it was so dirty.
It was dirty, but this could be, we don't know what's in this.
Well, what are you suggesting, Sonny?
But I think
when
you think about this at the elemental level, here we are as attorneys and also as people in the media and journalism. You know, at bottom, a case, an investigation, is about evidence. Mm-hmm. And journalism, particularly I think television journalism, which is part of what we're talking about, is often about sources. And when we do it well, we also try to reach heavily into evidence. But the notion that in this world where people feel, particularly I think on the internet, not only that they can find their own view, I mean that's I think surface level and socially has always happened to some degree, and we are mm-hmm. a segregated society in so many ways, class, race, religion, otherwise, particularly in many parts of the country, but then the comfort with which people today feel, well, I can find my own evidence. Jeffrey, you're talking about it with mm-hmm. through the press, but especially on the internet, and it's not that what they find is completely false. There may be a version of
it,
and then they go take refuge in that, and that strikes me as somewhat different than the pre-internet world, even though I happen to be clear, pro-internet.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing that I find, you know, pulled in two directions on. I mean, I love the internet. I mean, I think Twitter is fantastic. I'm not so much with Facebook, but I if you are remotely curious about the world, the information available to you is inconceivably better mm-hmm. than you could have imagined even 20 years ago. You know, there's an election in Israel. We can all read the Israeli papers if we want. I mean, you used to have to go to a newsstand and...
Jeffrey, wait, does everyone here know where Israel is?
Yeah.
Not this audience.
I know. It's a small liberal democracy-ish. So that's great, and I love professional golf, and I can get so much information about it on the internet. It's fantastic, but you know it does silo us off, and you know you can choose to follow certain people on Twitter and not others, and you get a very different perspective on the world. But you know, I mean, not that the internet's going to go anywhere, but the idea that the internet is an all-purpose villain, which it sometimes seems to be, mm-hmm. I think is incorrect.
What I'm going to do here is turn to some of the questions that you all have submitted. I think this works best if we keep it fast, snappy answers,
around.
And that way we'll get through more of the questions that represent some of what I've been submitted to from you via the why. Any inkling why Mueller didn't interview Donald Trump Jr.?
Great question. How about Donald Trump Sr.?
While we're at it.
Well, yeah. I think, you know, with Trump Sr., the issue was the legal fight would have taken a long time. They might have lost, I guess, although I don't know that for sure. Donald Trump Jr., I think it's mysterious. I mean, the Senate or House, one of the House or Senate Intelligence Committee did investigate him, and it was that testimony was reviewed by Mueller. But it's a good question.
Yeah, I don't know.
Well, I don't know. One thing you know we should all know is often targets of investigations are not interviewed by prosecutors and agents. Now, we don't know whether Trump Jr. is or is not a target of an investigation.
Well, that's we know he's not.
But that's
now. I mean, he's not.
Not by the special counsel.
Oh, come on. I mean,
I'm saying we don't. Look, we don't know.
What could they indict him for? I mean, I don't know.
I'm not suggesting that you could. I think that's a fact we should consider. We don't know why he wasn't interviewed by the special counsel.
I think it was odd that, you know, Donald Trump Sr. Had him issue that statement about the Trump Tower meeting, and he had him say that the meeting was about Russian adoptions, when we later found out, just a few days later, that it wasn't about Russian adoptions, that it was really about Hillary Clinton's emails. I would have, if I'm prosecuting that case, I want to speak to him about that.
Of course, yeah, no, I mean, I completely agree, which makes it all,
you would speak to him about that.
And we know that Mueller interviewed lots of people involved with that Air Force One creation of the false description of the Trump Tower meeting. All the more reason to talk, you know, I talked to Hope Hicks and that other PR guy whose name I forget. So,
it may be that for that he just decided it was too cumulative. There may be something else.
Too cumulative? Are you kidding me?
You want him.
Really?
We're trying to figure out.
You're saying you didn't get to it. What does that mean?
Meaning he interviewed Hope Hicks and he interviewed all these other people. I think what we're all saying is it's hard.
No, but that's not how you run an investigation.
That's what I'm saying. It's hard to come up with
You go up the line and if you have something.
That's my point.
Well, let me ask you a twist since you brought up Donald Trump Sr., who some people say is more important than Donald Trump Jr.
I would say. I would agree with that.
Do you think, this is strictly hypothetical, but do you think if they were moving towards conspiracy, say charging four other Americans, that then Mueller would have crossed over the line into saying, I'm going to have to go to court to demand an in-person interview with the president?
So it depends on what his objective was. What it seems is that part of his objective was speed. I mean, in the scheme of independent counsel, special counsel, you know, investigations of senior government officials, this was lightning fast. This was incredibly fast.
Not even 2 years.
And that doesn't happen by accident. That happens if that's a priority. And to Mueller's credit, if that was a priority, and it seems to be, you know, good for him, because an investigation like this is disruptive to the presidency, it's disruptive to the country, it's disruptive to the government, all of that. Now, one of the reasons to not press to try to get an interview or testimony with the president is that it would take a long time, because here's how it plays out. He invited the president to come in and sit
down. Remember the whole thing about Snappy?
Oh, sorry. Yeah.
You remember that?
Okay.
It was only a couple minutes ago.
I thought this was my show.
I got another question.
Anyway.
What? This is part of my job. You know.
Yeah, no, keep going.
This is from the audience. By a show of hands, how many people have heard of Snoop Doggy Dogg? All right, so this is a workable reference. I'm really reading this. It says here, Jeffrey, as Snoop said, Death Row is the label that pays me. Wow. Seems like Putin is the label that pays Donald Trump. Shug ultimately went to prison. It's a deep Death Row reference. Do you see anything that compromises Trump or that could send him to prison when he leaves office?
No, I don't. I really don't. No, I, people hate this guy so much, they want him to go to prison. I mean, like, get yourself under control. You know, I don't see him going to prison. I mean, you know, that's my snappy answer.
I think that there are still some investigations going on inside of the Southern District of New York. I think Michael Cohen has been cooperating, and I think we should stay tuned.
Agree. I agree with Sonny. Sipping on gin and juice laid back. Am I right?
Got my mind on my money and my money on my mind,
there
yes.
There you go.
But how does that apply?
It doesn't. It's my only Snoop Dogg quote.
The president doesn't even drink, you know. Although I read recently that gin is actually a type
nothing
of flavor.
Like middle-aged white Jewish guys talking about Snoop Dogg.
Music brings people together,
it's
Jeffrey.
It's true, I know, it's beautiful.
I read recently that gin is actually just a type of flavored vodka.
That's what I heard.
You heard this?
I have not heard
every time
that.
You're ordering gin, you're at, it's just a marketing thing they got because it's actually vodka.
No, but no, it's no, made from
I'm
a different
a Scotch guy.
Outside of my expertise.
Yeah.
Kurt Ackerman says, do you think some of the authors of the Mueller report will speak out publicly if Barr redacts important parts of it, if they view that as somehow illegitimate?
I don't think so. I think they play by the rules.
Yeah.
I think, you know, they work in the Justice Department, and I'm writing a book about it. I hope they talk to me, but but I don't think they'll speak out publicly.
No, not that team.
Do you really think, though, that a like you writing a book could advance your career? Like, was that your experience with OJ?
I need a rap reference about how money here. I'm hoping to advance my career every day.
Because we grew up, well, some of us, you know, we grew up reading the OJ book for a case that is so fraught and so complex. Mm-hmm. And your book on that, I'm sure a lot of people have read that, right?
Yeah.
It holds up to this day as beyond the fact that it was such a case, as a fascinating dive into a case.
Good story.
Great book.
Thank you.
Sonny?
What was the question? Sorry.
I don't know. Say something nice about my book.
I like the nine also.
The nine too.
I like the nine.
Everything. The New York, everything. Like
this is the blurb section of the panel.
That's right.
I hope you have a publicist recording some of this. It's usable.
Absolutely.
Another question. Is there anything that can be done between doing nothing and impeachment?
People can vote during the 2020
Ross, you were
talking
about that.
Yeah. So the answer, there are two things that that can be done, maybe three things. One is journalists can expose things and the public can take them in. That's one. Two is an election.
Yeah.
We can all go out and vote and participate in our democracy. Mm-hmm. And then certainly Congress actually has a couple of options. It has budgetary authority and it does have the authority to hold hearings and hold them in public and disclose things. Mm-hmm. It's not the job of prosecutors in the Justice Department to write reports and to publicize findings. That's not what they do. That is one of the jobs of Congress.
Senator Warner of Virginia has talked a lot about the need to start regulating the internet a little more. And for example, just, you know, we're all familiar with the disclaimers that come with political commercials. You know, I'm so-and-so and I approve this message. Mm-hmm. Some sort of labeling process that would go on social media, Facebook, et cetera, that I think, you know, that's a law that Congress could pass that you know, I think would have some impact.
Yeah. And Nixon resigned.
Nixon did resign.
Right? So there's something else.
Yeah,
there
is political pressure. Yeah.
This one has really nice penmanship, which you don't see nowadays very often. I believe it's by Julie. If the House decides not to impeach because the Senate won't convict, so that reverse engineering, which obviously Speaker Pelosi and others have referred to that as a calculus. Mm-hmm. This questioner poses, I think, a profound question. Will this establish Trumpism as a new norm, a precedent, a lowering of the normative bar? If so, should we not still consider impeachment to save the presidency itself?
Yes.
The writer also was one of the one of the founding fathers. It has that sweeping rhetoric.
And I'm with Julie.
Rhetoric. You're with Julie.
That's where I am.
Founding and fathers
I've,
and mothers.
I've said that on our show many times. I mean, just because you're not going to get a conviction doesn't mean that you don't call people to account. I mean, that is the job of the House, in my view. And this kind of behavior is so inappropriate and has been so inappropriate. If there are impeachable offenses outlined in the Mueller report, then I think that is Congress's duty.
I really do disagree about that. I am much more in the Pelosi camp that impeachment is a political, not a legal process.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, Pelosi, Nadler, they are haunted by the experience of 1998, where they felt like the Republicans pushed impeachment in the face of certain failure in the Senate and were punished by the electorate, and they're not going to do that again. Now, I do think that there is an accountability moment for Donald Trump. So it's not like no impeachment means he gets a total pass on everything. The accountability is the election. And that's where we will get the verdict on whether this is a new norm or not.
Mm-hmm. All right, very quickly on this, Julie asked, I think, what is going to be probably the key question that people are going to be asking after the Mueller report, mm-hmm. if there's bad substantive stuff about it.
And snap. Julie, do you want to stand up?
Yeah, no Julie, pressure, come on. We love you, up. Julie.
And, Julie? And, it's totally up. Julie's right here.
Julie, yes,
right
here. Julie. Yeah.
Right. And here's the and here's why. So let's say there's all sorts of bad stuff. I think what's going to happen is there is going to be pressure put on Nancy Pelosi and the Democratic House leadership to do something,
yeah.
to do something. And there are actually practical implications, I think, about calling something an impeachment process and not. You may actually do better in court trying to enforce subpoenas to try to get information by calling it an impeachment process. You might do better trying to get grand jury materials. Anyway, there is going to, I think, going to be some pressure put on Nancy Pelosi to do something and to call that something part of an impeachment process. But Jeffrey's right, for political reasons, I think there's going to continue to be resistance to that because Nancy Pelosi does not want to be Newt Gingrich, and there are all
yes.
sorts of problems for House leadership once they do something and call it impeachment.
That is true.
You motivate Trump's base, you draw attention to yourself, you set expectations. How do you justify not actually voting to impeach him once, you know, when you actually control
and
the whole
I,
House,
I also
right?
want to speak to Julie on your question. I, in my job, do not have a position on how this should go down with regard to this president at this point in time. Full caveat. But what you are speaking to is the fundamental constitutional accountability question. Mm-hmm. And I think, I would say this about any Speaker of the House and any president, in any hypothetical, it is the wrong direction to prejudge the assessment of potential high crimes by whether or not, in advance, you can project the outcome. Mm-hmm. Any more than, by the way, people could project Donald Trump's election. Mm-hmm. Or a million other things. But it's also not a responsible constitutional position. And I think it speaks to, we talk a lot about norms, it speaks to the kind of real politic, out in the open, blatant kind of public partisan calculating that goes on, that it is considered even a legitimate or acceptable thing. Because again, I'm not speaking about this president, but if Julie presents to us a situation where a sitting president has clearly been presented with evidence of committing high crimes or future high crimes on top of what they already did, or has been proven hypothetically of stealing one election and they might steal another. It cannot be that the constitutional answer begins with, I don't know, what are they going to do over there? I just don't think that's what the founders intended with this check.
And if you notice, what Speaker Pelosi said was, you know, pump the brakes. We haven't seen the report yet. If there are impeachable offenses found, then we will talk. So she gave herself.
She did, but I think she and others
some
also referred
room.
To the Senate math as if that predetermines this process. And I just think that's a dangerous mechanism to go down.
Can I just make an observation, which is really a question, not is just to go back to the media issue here. Is that, you know, Nancy Pelosi has said, and all these new Democratic members of Congress have said, we won by talking about health care, by mm-hmm. talking about taxes, by talking about, you know, pre-existing condition. I mean, you're familiar with the issue profiles that won the Democrats the House of Representatives. Why do we, and I mean MSNBC, I mean CNN, we talk about the scandal stuff constantly, but the politicians run away from it. Now, why is that? And I don't know the answer to that.
Sonny?
I don't know that I know the answer.
It's okay.
We have to ask Julie.
Yeah, Julie knows.
Yeah.
Well, look, I'm going to do three more before okay. we wrap, unless you have a quick thought.
Yeah, very quick. I think the reason is it doesn't move votes like those other issues. It doesn't affect votes. Just very quickly, I think the rationalization we are going to hear from from House leadership if the Mueller report is bad. The rationalization for not doing anything is all this political stuff. It's also that historically there's been an analogy of the impeachment process to a prosecution that is in advance of a trial. And it is typical for prosecutors to actually look at what they can do with a jury and to not charge crimes if they aren't sure they can get a conviction. I think you're going to hear that as sort of a principled reason for not impeaching.
I think that's true and a fair and nuanced point. But at the end of the day, no president has ever been forcibly removed from office. The Senate, in that, as you refer to that process, acquitted Johnson and Clinton. Mm-hmm. Nixon left under the pressure, the implicit threat, but also in a different environment of what it meant to process facts and be presented with that and feel that he had to go, and he made that decision. We've never used it. So, again, I just think that still countenances the other direction, which is by that logic, historically, we're even more polarized, it's even harder to get a supermajority, then you'd never really go down the road of using this. And you could make the counterargument, again, I'm speaking about a hypothetical president, because the fact that there's no chargeable conspiracy in Mueller's eyes was a big piece of good news for the White House. But the systemic question of, is it valuable to go through that process if you think there's evidence of high crimes that leads to impeachment or censure or other things, because you don't know where it goes afterward, that was the whole point of the House's role.
And it's the point Sonny made, which is that in the Nixon case, at the beginning of the process, people didn't think that Nixon would actually be removed. Yeah. And it wasn't until his poll numbers dropped into the basement that became a reality.
So I'm a stickler for meeting our commitments. We're about near our end, so I'm going to read three final questions. Read them out to you guys. You can tackle some of them and also give any final thought you want to give. One of them, Tubin had his moment in the sun. I think we all remember that for the book.
Which one?
We all loved your book.
One? Oh, my moment in the sun
Right here, yeah.
I feel like the sun has shone on us throughout this event.
So, New Yorker, the book, esteemed television career. I didn't plant this, but there is a much more left-handed compliment here of me that I guess I will read from Jessica, who identifies as 27. And this is a left-handed compliment, you'll see. I'm a fan of yours, Ari, but, always a but. But I've never seen your show. Okay, thank you, Jessica, for being a fan. But, now there's a second but. But I have watched all the clips that have been posted on the Beat with Ari Instagram page.
Uh-huh. That's how people consume.
With people like me, younger generations, getting their news from social media, mm-hmm. how informed do you think we are and compared to the older generations? One. Two, this is for all of us. Do you think Mueller was letting SDNY file their charges knowing the evidence there could be more concrete and then easier to prove that things the president could not pardon? From JR. And then this one, four words. Where's Rod Rosenstein? Oh.
Well, the second question I think is pretty easy. I don't think Mueller was like strategizing with the Southern District. I think he was just trying to do his job, and the Southern District will fall where they may. It's an interesting question about is the younger generation less informed? I think anyone who speaks about the younger generation is obviously a very old person. So I would be pleased to say, I don't know.
I think as the mother of teenagers, I know that my teenagers at least, don't consume media in the way that I do. They don't watch television, but they consume it on social media. They are very informed because they have more news coming at them. My concern sometimes is sourcing. Sometimes they get their information from some outlets that I don't think are as trustworthy as they could be. But by and large, I think they are very informed. As for the Southern District and whether or not the president can pardon, because the Southern District is a federal prosecutorial arm, the president can pardon. Sure. And that's problematic. But if a state agency or prosecutorial arm starts investigating and perhaps charges, then the president cannot pardon. So I suspect that that may be an avenue there.
Yep. So a couple things. I agree Ari does a great job. Second, I'm not sure, you know, as Jeffrey was alluding to, I'm not sure whether we can judge whether young people are as informed as they were before or not. But I think there's a recognition that they are differently informed. They're getting their information from different places. And I think the smart journalists are reaching out and trying to get to young people where they are. But Sonny's right. It's hard to source information on the internet. There's that New Yorker cartoon, you know, with the dog sitting there looking at the screen saying, on the internet, nobody knows you're a dog. That I think, is the issue. I'm going to actually be a little more concerned. If I were the president, I would be more concerned about the Southern District than perhaps people have suggested. Sonny's right. You can pardon people in the Southern District. It's a federal jurisdiction. But if I were the president, and I've been practicing law for, I don't know, 25 years. If I had a client in the president's position, in the position of his businesses, knowing what I know, I would be very, very concerned about the Southern District of New York.
Yeah, I'll take a crack at a couple on our way out. I mean, I think the Southern District is especially significant because it's an open investigation that doesn't have the time deadlines that Mueller had and deals with business and financial activities. And it is where a confessed election crime occurred. Mm-hmm. And it is where other outlets, National Enquirer, other arrangements, other very off the books, over the line, on the line things have already been exposed. So what else is there like that? Do you think those were one-offs and that was the only time those things ever happened, or do you think the investigators are digging into all of that? They have a reputation for being aggressive and independent. They should also be careful and thoughtful. I don't think they are out to take out the President of the United States, but I do think you could see, it would be conceivable, that those investigations would continue to complicate matters for some of those players in the Trump organization. But none of that, I think, cuts against the larger points that we discussed tonight, including constitutional accountability and the fact that there was no chargeable collusion, but there was a lot of other crime uncovered. All those things, to me, are, like, more macro. Where's Rod Rosenstein?
Hmm.
You know, he's packing up. He's getting out. He's no longer number one, which he was as acting attorney general under the recusal rule. So while he's there and Barr has very cleverly invoked him in the letter, but he didn't co-sign the letter, and he invokes Mueller, but we don't know whether they agree or not on this stuff. So there's a lot of that kind of dance going on. As for Jessica's question, well, Jessica, I don't know if you ever listened to Miley Cyrus.
Uh-oh.
Who said, if you mean it, I'll believe it. If you text it, I'll delete it. And I think across generations, even though digital natives grow up in a different way and are clearly faster and more sophisticated about certain aspects of this stuff, I do think, and the bottom level line, we still know, Miley's saying about it, we all know that as rich communication can be online, including media, it's communication. It's not that next level of substance. And so there's an amazing way that people are connecting online. Activism is faster. You can learn about things fast. You can sign up in all sorts of ways. You can stay posted. But there's a difference, I think, which is not to say don't do it, but there is a difference between going on Instagram and watching some of the clips and engaging with people, which is still better than nothing, and younger people can do it more quickly while they work a job or go to school or live life. But there's a difference between that and actually showing up at the Women's March and meeting new people and engaging that way. I think it is a mistake of people in our older generation to treat that as some sort of binary choice. It wasn't a choice in the old days when you had a landline in college and you sometimes talked on the phone and sometimes met up with people, and it's not a choice now. if someone is only watching the clips from my show, I could tell you, and that someone is named Jessica, you might be getting some of the stuff that is more likely to go viral and share, but isn't necessarily the rest of the longer, deeper substance. So we would hope, to use an analogy that I think most parents are comfortable with, we would hope to treat Instagram as a gateway addictive drug to watching The Beat on a regular basis. And while I say that jokingly and obviously self-interestedly, I would encourage you even more to use it as a gateway drug to make sure you subscribe to at least one newspaper, to be behind the paywall, to be committed, to read The Times or The Journal or The Washington Post, in addition to all the other stuff, because that's where I think the generations might actually meet. Those of us who are older need to be open-minded about what's going on down there and not assume we know what it is or what it isn't. Mm-hmm. And those of you who may be younger should remember that there's a reason why all this other stuff has existed for so long and has value, and maybe we meet in the middle and do some learning about each other. Mm-hmm. As for the overarching theme of what do we do with what we're going to learn in the Mueller report, I would end where we began, with a pandering Jewishy joke. How many therapists does it take to screw in a light bulb? One, but the light bulb has to want to change. Thank you for being here. Thanks to our esteemed panelists.
Good job. Yeah.
Well done. That was good.
Good job.
Fun.